Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Politics Uncensored with your host, Ali Milani. I am delighted to have you back for another episode of Politics Uncensored. I'm also delighted that in between week one and week two, I was not cancelled. So we're still here and we're still talking about the issues facing our politics across the UK and the world. We've got an amazing show for you this week. We're going to be looking specifically at gender equality and gender-based violence, in particularly the issues that face young women in the UK and issues surrounding sexual harassment and violence. I'll be speaking to Shay Faludin Lebird, who is a co-founder of Level Up, Vera Hobhouse, Liberal Democrat MP for Bath, and Jess Lee, spokesperson for Our Streets Now. But first, I'm joined by a brilliant co-host, Ellie Flynn, investigative journalist and broadcaster, who has made a number of documentaries for BBC and Channel 4, and has looked at the rise of dangerous landlords exploiting vulnerable women, the issues of sexual harassment, and most recently and prominently did a wonderful documentary on sexual harassment and violence, which featured Ellie pretending to be drunk outside of a club and seeing the reaction she gets. Thank you so much for joining us, Ellie.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that documentary? Because it's gone everywhere.
Yeah, I was so surprised by sort of how much it took off. As you said, it was a documentary looking at the scope of sexual harassment facing women and young girls today in the UK. We did a series of experiments, and one of them was me being sent dick pics on dating apps, which I was like inundated with. And then the one that sort of really got picked up and went viral was me pretending to be drunk on a night out in two locations in the UK. In London and in Liverpool, and I was followed and harassed on multiple occasions by men who seemed to notice that I was drunk or apparently drunk, and then tried to take advantage of that. So yeah, it was scary stuff.
Yeah, and I think one of the striking things since the clips have come out and gone viral is the number of women who've spoken about how that is very much their experience on nights out, and you know. I don't think you portrayed in your documentary, you know, the extremes or something going really wrong on a night out, but this is a regular experience for women in the UK.
Exactly. And I think that was what was most striking for me. After the documentary went out, I was getting all these messages, and from men it was like, oh my God, I can't believe this happens. And from women it was like,
yep,
here are five times that exact same thing happened to me. And it just really, really resonated.
Yeah. And I think, one of the things that I think our listeners, the men listening, could do is if you're in a group, a social circle with a number of your friends who are women, they will tell you just the everyday experience of issues of sexual harassment, sexual assault that go on every day. And I think your documentary highlighted that. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But first, we've got the Week Unwrapped, where we talk about the most pressing political stories in the UK. And first, we're going to talk about Hamza Yousaf, the new Scottish National Party leader and now Scotland's First Minister. Hamza is the first Asian Brit who has become the leader of the SNP and the First Minister. He's the youngest First Minister at 37. And like I said, the first from a minority ethnic background. This is huge. We now have a prime minister from an Asian background, we have a mayor of London from an Asian background, and we have a Scottish first minister from an Asian background. What do you think that has to say about the UK? Where are we at? I mean, it's certainly progress from where we were 20 years ago.
Absolutely. I think that, yeah, it's huge progress, and I think it's something that as a country we should be really proud of. And I think that it does say a lot about the progress that's been done over the past few years. So I think that will be... It's just so great for, like, I think, kids who are growing up today who, like, want to hold those positions, who want to make a difference, to be able to see people who are like them being represented in the most powerful positions in the country. I just think that, you know, that's always a good thing.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid and we would turn on the news or we would see PMQs or whatever, not that we watched it at any great frequency. but, you know, the common thing is they don't look like us, they don't sound like us, they don't know what life is like us. And I think, you know, I'm certainly not an advocate for representation as, you know, just that sort of representation is all that's needed. I think policy and politics is is as important. But I think, like you said, young kids seeing someone that looks like them, seeing someone who has comes from a background like them, will certainly make politics more accessible. And I think the thing that's broken the internet, certainly for the far right, is Hamza posted a picture of himself leading prayer because it's Ramadan, and he was leading prayer with his family. And I've seen Nigel Farage respond to it, and it really seems to have broken the internet. So I think, you know, we're in a moment now where there's going to be a real conversation around the inclusivity of politics and what people like Rishi, like Sadiq, like Hamza represent in our politics. He's also the youngest first minister, so he's only 37.
So young.
Yeah, I that's often something that I don't think is discussed in our politics. I walk around the House of Commons often, the Palace of Westminster, and I feel like being there, I've dropped the average age by like 20 years.
Yeah, right, because you've got similar experience. You were very young when you first did. And I think that, I mean, that in itself as well, I think is so important to have young voices going into Westminster, going into Holyrood. I think it's that is what we need. I think that young people more and more need to be like represented in politics. Mm-hmm. But it's, I mean, he was like 26 when he was when he first became a minister. Yeah. Which is,
have you seen the emo pictures of him?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's amazing. He went through an emo phase, clearly, and it's been all
well,
over.
When he was a minister. Yeah,
no, well, I don't know.
He was young enough.
But there's been pictures of him, like with the emo fringe and stuff.
Oh,
the phase
God,
that we
so
all went
funny.
Through.
Yeah.
People born in 1950s and 60s wouldn't have gone through that same phase because the culture was different. So I think
I would kind of love to have seen that, like my mum going through an emo phase in her 30s.
Or Ian Duncan Smith going through an emo phase. I would have loved to have seen that. But it's true, you know, you walk around Westminster and everyone's like 103 years old. But look, the point I think is there are things that come with young politicians and candidates. I mean, Barack Obama, when he got elected, was one of the youngest presidents to have gotten elected. And I think there's two real things that I think young candidates bring. I think political courage. You're less sort of battle-hardened, yes, but you're also less cynical because you've not for years been beaten down by the politics. So when you're younger, you have a little bit more courage to try ideas that might be a little bit radical or might be a little bit out there. And there's a bit of, I think there's an impatience that comes with youth, mm-hmm. An impatience for change, which I think is a really, really good thing. Because often when we talk about some of the serious issues, yes, there are long roads and yes, things happen slowly. But I just think young people bring with them a certain impatience for change to happen right now.
Yeah.
That when you look at the economy, climate change, some of the gender-based violence that we're going to talk about, we can't really wait.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think as well that, you know, young people in the past few elections have been some of the hardest groups to reach. You know, they don't go out and vote. They don't feel like represented really in politics. And I think that maybe seeing younger politicians leading parties in ministerial positions and sort of making waves in politics could be the thing that really inspires young people to feel a bit more seen, feel a bit more represented, and hopefully get involved in politics in whatever way that might be.
Yeah. Okay, so our next story is talking about Rishi Sunak. So Rishi Sunak is attempting to crack down on antisocial behaviour by banning the sale of laughing gas. So those of you who won't know what this is, you may have seen these small little silver canisters that are sometimes recreationally taken because of the effect that it has. I believe it's the same laughing gas that they give pregnant women when they're giving birth.
Gas and air.
I've only ever seen it used once at football when someone broke their leg really badly and they gave them gas and air. And I will say his reaction was hilarious when he got it.
But, having had a baby, I can tell you that stuff is magic.
Yes, okay. So the plan is to address things like homelessness, begging and graffiti, but particularly the story has been around laughing gas. What is your take on this? I mean, it just seems... ridiculous to me.
I don't think it's going to stop. I don't think that it being made a Class C drug is going to stop people who want to take it from taking it. I don't really think it is an effective solution. I think it's, you know, someone described it as like the same old tired drug policy. And I think that, you know, all it is potentially going to do is push it, drive it into criminal hands, which, you know, creates other issues in itself. So it feels like a... it feels like a strange place to be clamping down to me. But there are also health risks with it. And, you know, I think that there are concerns around some of the damage that it can do for people who use it regularly. So, you know, maybe that's where they're coming from.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it seems to me to be a reaction to the Conservatives' polling numbers, because it's one of those issues that you just know that these MPs have heard about the canisters being around, their communities have heard about antisocial behaviour, and it's just a reactionary sort of policy, I think, to their polling numbers, and they're thinking of, you know, what are some easy things that might be popular within our communities. But like you said, it's just a tide. I think our drug policy in general is so poor. It's not based on any sort of health data or what expert opinions are, and it always just seems reactionary. I'll tell you what it seems like to me. It seems like, and I often get frustrated at this, politicians, when they want to seem tough, when they want to look big and strong and tough, they always go for the low-hanging fruit, which is, you know, antisocial behavior or migrants, or, you know, how can we, rather than dealing with the underlying issues of antisocial behavior, which may be economic policy, which may be, you know, poverty and deprivation, they go after things like laughing gas, just to look tough.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe it is kind of like an easy way to appear to be acting tough on something. And I don't know, I think that there have been complaints from maybe some people about like the litter caused by it, but it does, I see where you're coming from. It does seem like a strange, just like a strange place to be focusing, mm-hmm. with everything else that's going on at the moment, for this to be the kind of like the direction that they're...
Surely it hasn't worked. Like, well, if you look at the way that they dealt with marijuana, mm-hmm. it didn't bring down usage.
No, exactly. I mean, I feel like it's definitely not going to bring down usage. I mean, even the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs have said that, you know, they didn't advise the government to make it a Class C drug. Mm. So it's going against all advice from sort of medical professionals who know this area. I don't think it's going to stop anyone from taking it. It might just clean up parks a little bit.
Yeah.
But maybe that is the intention, really, as opposed to seeing it as a controlled substance.
Yeah, I definitely think it's indicative of what has been decades of failed sort of drug policy. So Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, has also been out and about talking about his plans to tackle crime. And one of the key lines that he has run, one of his key policy areas, has been to halve violence against women and girls within a decade. And that is in line with the theme of our show today. And Keir Starmer has spoken about introducing things like dedicated rape courts to increase conviction rates and domestic violence experts taking 999 calls. This is an area, obviously, where you're extremely passionate about and something you've spoken about quite mm-hmm. a lot. What do you think about this call to halve violence against women and girls?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely welcome anyone in Westminster or, you know, that's going to be taking this seriously, because I think it is one of the biggest issues that we face today. I think that if you just look at the past few years at some of the cases we've seen, the recent report into the Met Police, you know, there's so many issues that really, really need to be addressed. And I think for a long time, violence against women and girls has just not been seen as a priority. So I think to see politicians putting it on the agenda and sort of like, you know, right at the top of that agenda mm-hmm. is a really, really positive thing.
What do you think about, so the two examples, specific examples he cited, is the dedicated rape courts, dedicated courts to increase conviction rates for sexual assault and rape, domestic violence experts taking 999 calls.
Yeah, I mean, both sound good in theory. I'd be interested to know a bit more about what he means by dedicated rape courts and how that would work in theory. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the current system for rape cases is dire.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, even just getting something into court is really difficult. I think it's a 1 in 100 rape cases end up with a charge, and that's before you even get to a conviction. So I think that there definitely needs to be more resources ploughed into how we can look at effectively handling rape cases and how we can get more convictions, you know, when there is evidence that it's happened, which in most cases there are.
I don't know how many people know just how appalling the conviction rate for rape is.
Yeah. It's essentially decriminalised.
And, you know, the experience that women go through when they go in to report cases. So they're often, you know, feel like, and I've heard this from lots of women, when they've gone in to describe you know, what is an extremely traumatic experience, then the atmosphere and culture is that they're not believed, that the onus is on them to prove. And then in the end, they know that the conviction rate, 1 in 100,
yeah,
you know, is when it ends up in court. And I think the conviction rate is in the single digits percentages.
Yeah.
So it's
there's
horrific.
So many barriers, and the emotional trauma of going through something like that is so huge when you've already suffered such an enormous emotional trauma. So, you know, it's something needs to be seriously done. There was a brilliant documentary for Channel 4 a couple of years ago that was called Rape, Who's on Trial, that sort of unpicked a lot of this. And, you know, some of the things that they looked at are just the way that victims have to, you know, repeatedly go through their account. And then, you know, like when you're questioned on that in court, it's all so traumatic. And you know, if there were dedicated rape courts that were able to deal with that in a way that is more effective than the situation we have at the moment, then, you know, that can only be a good thing.
So coming up after this, we have Shayi Faludin-Labod, co-founder of Level Up and a feminist community campaigner for gender-based justice in the UK.
FUBAR Radio presents
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville.
We've got our first guest of the day in, and he goes by the name Vice Beats.
I've not been on Twitter for years, so like I've now remembered that exists.
So what, did you just find out about Brexit?
Yeah, everyone was like, the B word.
What are you
talking
about?
Who is this? So like, apparently something's going on.
Is this thing now called being woke as well? I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah,
you missed that. You missed that.
So I just thought I'd been awake, and then someone was like, "Cancel culture, are you woke?"
I was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's been great.
Joey Page. I'm delighted to have Craig from Flying Vinyl in the studio. Craig, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's a music subscription service where you send people a monthly subscription of vinyl.
Yeah, I bought a box set for you as well.
Oh, bless you.
Recently, our product got banned from China briefly because we had the revolution written on the front of the box. They didn't like that.
Oh.
It was music, and it hasn't been vetted by the Chinese authorities. So
that's a nightmare. Did you just like recover it and send it out?
Yeah. It's not like revolution against the government, but
Access All Areas.
And we have our final guest. You know him.
Do you know how much I love this guy?
Well, he's here on the phone right now. Hello, David McIntosh.
Yo, what's up, guys?
We love you on TV, David. Are you going to do more of this? Because I'd love to see you in the jungle. I think you'd be like the proper Tarzan.
Oh, I would. Is the jungle a test for me? I would love it. Do you know what I mean? But is it a test?
Could you cope with all the bugs crawling all over you?
You know what? I couldn't.
See, I would like to see.
I'd love that. Have you been out with a few snakes? So you'll be fine. I didn't say that.
Yes. You know, you're right, you've got it. High five, you're high fiving right now.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani for Politics Uncensored. We are now really blessed to have Shayi Faludin-Labod joining us, a co-founder of Level Up and a feminist community campaigner for gender justice in the UK. Shayi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about gender-based violence and the experiences of women in the UK. Can you tell us a little bit about your organisation? I know one of the key things you guys have been doing is creating digital tools and campaigns to interrupt cultural moments. One of the big ones I saw was flying the banner over a football match, so things like that. Can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah, so Level Up is a feminist campaigning community that works to organise and deliver campaigns, as you said, focused around gender justice. We really do focus on cultural and pop cultural moments because we really feel like those are the real vehicles for change, especially right now. So, like you said, we flew a plane over Ronaldo's return match to Manchester United. He had a pending rape case open at the time, so it was in solidarity with Catherine Mayorga, the victim. We're also working to end pregnant sentences for pregnant women and pregnant people. And just now, actually, we handed in a petition of 26,000 people to IPSO, the press regulator, around how the press are able to report on fatal domestic abuse.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about that, the more recent one, the petition.
Oh gosh, the way that the media reports domestic abuse in general, but abuse that results in death, It's often framed as, you know, justified in some way. Mm. It's often the victim's fault. The press often find ways to empathize with the perpetrator. And we know that that means that it lowers empathy for the victim, and it increases empathy for the perpetrator, but it also reinforces kind of that normalization of domestic abuse, and it kind of throws it away as like frivolous when people are actually dying at the end of it. We know that it's that fatal domestic abuse happens after a prolonged period of time of abuse from coercion to mm-hmm. actual physical abuse.
Yeah. That was something I really noticed. I think it was at Epsom College.
Emma Patterson.
Yeah, that was
correct.
Awful. And I really remember that the reports around that were sort of like, you know, this quiet guy, and, you know, was she working too much?
Blaming her for
there
because
was so
she was an ambitious woman, or because, you know, she had a job outside the home. There's always almost speculation and trying to find a reason or justification for why she is responsible for her own murder, essentially.
We were also just talking about Keir Starmer's vow to halve violence against women and girls within a decade, and one of his pledges is to have dedicated 999 callers dealing with domestic violence. And Ellie, you were just talking to me before we came on air about, I think, a case in Kent where
it was, they recently had out a leaflet that was saying, you know, like there are some situations that aren't an emergency where you can just report the crime online, and they'd listed under the non-emergencies rape, domestic abuse, sexual assault. And, you know, it's just astonishing that people are still not understanding that, like, these are absolutely life-threatening emergency crimes that need to be treated as such.
Absolutely.
And police, for, I know, you know, the Met gets blamed for a lot, and, you know, you look at Baroness Casey's report, and of course rightly so, but it's not just the Met. There are, you know, there are issues up and down the country with police forces,
and it's not just police forces. There is a systemic violence that happens within our institutions. The fact that black women are 5 times more likely to die from childbirth, I mean, within our medical, that's an issue. The way that the media reports on the violence of our trans siblings, that's an issue. So there are so many of, like, we talk a lot about, like, the bodily violence, rape, domestic violence, and it's important that we are talking about those things. But it's also important to talk about the violence that comes from the systems that we create mm-hmm. and the things that we reinforce, you know, with our media and social media now and, you know, everything else.
It feels like we're in a cultural moment. I think, you know, we had the Me Too movement, which started in Hollywood, but certainly came through our politics. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of really horrific cases of women being killed and raped. Sarah mm-hmm. Everard being the most recent example.
Yeah.
And now we've got the sort of reports into the Metropolitan Police. I'll be honest with you. I've always thought, I was a candidate that ran in an election, and we were always told the police are a no-go area, right? You don't talk about the police. Mm-hmm. It's just too politically damaging to go to talk about the police, and now it seems like that's open. Do you think we are in a cultural moment where, you know, a lot of these issues that you are campaigning on have come to the fore, and there's an opportunity for change?
I really do feel that. The response that we had when Emma Patterson was murdered, people were outraged about the way that was reported in the media. And we actually reopened our petition in response to the reaction that we got. And so it really does feel like, I think we're just in that moment anyway. You've got the strikes happening. We're in a cultural moment where I think people are understanding and unlearning some of the things that they thought they knew to be true. And the fact that these, you know, institutions are there to serve us, I think a lot of us are realizing now that mm-hmm. that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're hearing a lot from government, from, you know, Humza Yousaf, from Keir Starmer about violence against women and girls, and it feels like politicians are trying to make this a priority. Do you feel like enough is being done in this space, or do you feel like it's all kind of paying lip service?
No, nowhere near. I think we have a huge over reliance on the criminal justice system to solve things like rape and domestic violence, when really we know they're about our attitudes as a culture, our collective practices and the things that we reinforce. There's so much work to be done around ensuring that women and non-binary people have the resources that they need, holistic resources that they need. There's work to be done around the mental health of men and boys and what that means and how that manifests for the rest mm-hmm. of us. You know, there is so much more to be done than just locking people up. But ultimately, we have to agree that we have a gender-based violence problem in this in the UK, and like racism, that's something that takes a little bit longer to convince people.
And I think, you know, there seems to be, as with most things, when we reach serious cultural moments where change is possible, there is a pushback.
Yeah.
And I think the Andrew Tates of this world, there are now more than one, and it's not just him. There's a few of mm-hmm. these rabid misogynist, you know, social media personalities yeah. who are pushing back. And this is where the conversation around educating young men is seriously important.
Yeah.
I know for me personally, I didn't really know the experiences of women and some of these issues that we've all spoken about today until university.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was sat in my kitchen with nine flatmates who are women and seeing what they go through on a day-to-day basis and hearing those stories. That's way too late, no?
Precisely. Precisely. There's work to be done around the experiences of course of women, but also about how both men and women are involved in upholding and reinforcing those things. And we all play a part in upholding some of the misogynistic kind of tropes that you know, we all hold. And so there has to be more of a conversation before you get to university. And it's not even just the conversation, it's the practice. It's you know, young boys or men being pulled up when they've done something that's inappropriate. It's women having the space, or young girls even having the space, to be able to say, I'm not comfortable with that, or this is my body what I do with it is my business.
Yeah.
And it's not for you to touch. So there is so much work, there's so much that needs to be done before, you know, kids even start talking.
Yeah. But often, you know? I feel like often the conversation is all around policing,
yeah,
or criminal justice, mm-hmm. or what is done at the end of the process.
That's
and
right.
Not a lot around, you know, how do we talk to young men and boys about how to behave?
Yeah.
How do we push back against, because I think Andrew Tate works and his elk work in a little bit of a vacuum.
That's right.
They're telling young men and boys, this is what it means to be a man. And no one else is having that conversation. So whether it's teachers or parents needing to sit down, you know, and I think organizations like yours and others have a huge, you know, we should be inviting in to kind of help shape those discussions. So the last question I have before this has flown by, is the intersection around race and gender.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that we're going to touch on a little bit later. When I spoke to some friends and colleagues around the theme of this show, one of the things I was told to speak about is how often that intersection is really, really important.
Yeah.
Is that something you guys work on as well?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason we talk about gender justice is because it's an approach that kind of encapsulates and recognizes that there are other social oppressions that affect people's lives as well. And so we have a campaign at the moment that is trying to get big beauty brands to remove toxic chemicals from their hair relaxers. A lot of research has come out recently about the connection between hair relaxers and a 30% increase in breast cancer and uterine cancer for Black women. So we're doing a campaign around that at the moment. But yeah, we are, I mean, race, class, disability, it's all really important that it's able to have a voice and a space, particularly in our feminist work. And that's the value in cross solidarity work and kind of cross movement work. So yeah, race has to be, I mean, it can't often, not be, I'm a Black woman as well, so it's just too difficult.
Well, I remember, you know, the more recent case, I think it was surrounding in one of the cases with the monarchy, there was some sort of event and one of the Black women at the event,
Sister Space?
Sister Space, mm-hmm. And then I started to look at Sister Space and you start to learn, you know, how... you know, there's all sorts of cultural work that needs to be done. So when we're talking about domestic violence, it's different, for example, when you come from different cultures, and dedicated work is really, really important to help drive them down. Mm-hmm. And I think work like organizations like yourselves and Sister Space goes such a huge way in breaking down those barriers and reaching people. Because often, you know, if we're talking about gender-based issues, it's there's so many intersections, like you said, race, class.
Too many different experiences. Yeah. And that's why it's important that those kind of very specialist organizations are resourced and funded.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Shay, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm learning so much just hearing about the work that you guys do. So that was Shay Falugan-Lebird, co-founder of Level Up, who are doing some incredible feminist community campaigning work for gender justice in the UK. And we are so pleased that you could join us. Coming up next, I spoke to Vera Hobhouse, who's a Liberal Democrat MP for Bath. She was elected in 2017 and served as the Liberal Democrat shadow leader of the House of Commons. She was the former Lib Dem spokesperson for women and equalities. Vera has worked on a private member's bill to amend the Sexual Offences Act of 2003. Her bill aimed at outlawing acts of voyeurism, especially upskirting, which were not explicitly covered by UK law at the time. And earlier this month, she called for misogyny to be made a hate crime. I spoke to Vera earlier today.
Well, it was fell right in the middle of this Me Too era, where more and more women were actually pointing to the fact where they're being harassed, and where acts of so-called non-contact sexual violence is still sexual violence and is felt by women deeply, and victims of upskirting and feel humiliated and feel hurt and ashamed, and a number of things that those who did the act either knew or needed to be pointed out to them. And the whole point about the making upskirting a specific criminal offence was really to create a culture where we say this is a vile offence, it's not for laugh, it creates victims, and we need to have a law that recognises the victims and is victim-centred.
Yeah, and so this has particularly come to light recently. We had the horrific Sarah Everard case, which I'm sure you know all about. But in the trial of Wayne Cousins, we heard how he had engaged in indecent exposure prior to his murder of Sarah. And so there's been a big conversation around how those offences aren't taken seriously, and if only they had, you know, maybe something could have been done to prevent the crime he went on to commit. But not just him. The discussion has generally been that issues like indecent exposure, issues like upskirting, are still not being taken seriously enough by the police. What would your response to that be?
Well, it's appalling that after 5 years now, we still haven't sort of instilled this culture where we understand that women are victims of these vile offences. And although there might be non-contact sexual offences, they're still sexual offences. And often, if you get away with minor offences, you go on to commit bigger crimes. And whatever, it is an offence. It should be an offence. It should be prosecuted properly. And victims should get justice. That they don't is a serious failure of the whole system, the police, the CPS, the courts. We just need to take these offences seriously and clamp down on them straight away. You need to do that and create a culture where women feel safe wherever they are, on our streets, in our workplaces, in our homes.
Yeah, and so I'm glad you said that. You spoke about women feeling safe wherever they are. Since your bill in 2018, we have heard quite a few stories and allegations against members of parliament and peers. There's been quite a few cases of MPs and peers being suspended, being charged with sexual harassment or sexual assault cases. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in the Houses of Commons and in the Palaces of Westminster, because it seems like the problem isn't just outside, it's inside.
Absolutely, and we have to sort of stamp it out. And Parliament has created tougher procedures, and I welcome those. And we need to be serious about cleaning up our own house, as we are about sort of trying to make a difference outside. So you're absolutely right. We can't preach to the outside if we ourselves as members of parliament not following the same rules. So we absolutely have to create rules for our behavior here in the House of Commons, as we are trying to create rules for people outside. It can't be rules for people there and then outside and rules for us. That is absolutely unacceptable. So a very tough climb down on any sexual assault or harassment in the House of Commons needs to be stamped out in the same way as it does everywhere else.
So earlier this month, you called for misogyny to be made a hate crime. Can you explain a little bit to the listeners what that would mean in practice?
So this is about creating safer workplaces where women particularly, but any employee, so it's just not about women, are protected from harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment, but other forms of harassment as well. And it creates a particular duty on employers to make sure that these instances are prevented. So there are new duties for employers, and there will be a code of conduct and guidelines that will be issued by the EHRC and to make sure that employers know what they have to do. Around the sexual harassment, there has been cross-party support for the bill. There has been a little bit of a hiccup around other forms of harassment in terms of speech, and there has been a danger, and it's not quite not quite clear yet because it has to pass the House of Lords whether you know, I get the cross-party and cross-house support for the bill, and that it will also affect any other forms of harassment and sexual harassment. People are worried that the bill would create something like a sort of, I think it's been labelled like the banter ban, which is nonsense. What we really want is to allow employees to feel safe to raise when they feel harassed, and to raise when things are being said or done that cross boundaries, and these workplaces are better workplaces, and most industries are totally behind the bill. So I hope it will pass its final hurdle in the House of Lords and become law.
This ban, you said that one of the criticisms that you've had has been that it's been seen as a bit of a banter ban. That's interesting to me because I think there is a cultural issue that's happening here, in that there are some folks certainly who have gotten away with or felt comfortable saying and doing things in the workplace that are just inappropriate for decades. And there seems to be a little bit of a cultural shift where now we're saying those things aren't acceptable, they shouldn't be said in the workplace. And there is a bit of resistance from some of the old cultural guard in that. Do you find that the case? Is that some of the resistance you face to the bill?
Yeah, I think you put it absolutely correctly. And as the minister said in her wind-up speech, and the government is supporting the bill, somebody's banter is another person's harassment. So we have to have open discussions about where the boundaries are. I'm a liberal. I don't want to forbid speech. I think we need to have free speech, but it has to be done in a respectful way. And it has to be done in a way that each side understands, what the boundaries are. These conversations have to be done and conducted in an atmosphere of mutual respect. And again, as I said before, this can only be an improvement in our workplaces. And those people who are trying to resist these sort of forms of respectful behavior towards each other, I simply cannot see what their point is.
The next point I want to quickly discuss with you before we let you go is the Metropolitan Police. That's been one of the major areas surrounding sexism and misogyny that have been discussed more recently. Baroness Casey did her report and found that the Met Police are institutionally sexist. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, how could I disagree with that? I think the most police forces have understood that they have to get their act together and change dramatically some of their cultures that exist with them. I do want to commend my own police force, Avon and Somerset Police. They are making really big strides and making progress against how they investigate violence against women and girls. And I think they should be seen as a lead force in this issue. The first is, of course, that each force recognizes where they need to do better and then put forward plans of how they're finally getting to grips with that. And each police force has to do that in their own way. The Met Police has been a particular focus, but it's not the only force where this happens. It's the biggest force in the country, and they're always seen a little bit as a sort of lead in everything. But look around the country and look to those police forces where where things are really making big progress towards improvement. But in the meantime, yeah, I mean, it's important that the police forces know where their culture is going completely wrong. I have asked for a long time that misogyny should actually be made a hate crime. The government has been resisting that for a long time. But I believe that actually if we make misogyny a hate crime, it would make also a very big difference for institutions like the Met Police.
Yeah, and so what practical steps do you think the Met Police need to be take to start to address this? You spoke about your own police force being perhaps a good example that the Met Police can look to. What are they doing that the Met Police aren't?
Well, I'm not a chief constable, so it's for the leaders of each police form to really sort of put forward a plan of what they're going to do in terms of training, but particularly in terms of vetting police officers. These are the steps that each police force has to do. But then once they sort of bring their own house in order, then for me it is particularly around how do you investigate violence against women and girls, and that's where the Operation Soteria Bluestone is very much a program that the police forces have set themselves have made big strides and so all I would say is I'm not managing a police force. I can only say from the outside where there's a culture that leads to these things and then make sure that we from Parliament scrutinise what police forces are doing and get the proper scrutiny. But in the end, it's for the management of the police, and that's basically the top. That's each chief constable of each police force to set out a plan of how they're going to improve.
Okay, and lastly, I wondered, you know, a lot of times when it comes to these issues, quite rightly, it's women leading the cause. What role do you think men have to play in being good allies on this issue? What call would you have to your male colleagues and our male listeners about what they can do to overcome some of the serious problems of sexism and misogyny that we have both in our politics and in our society?
Well, a huge role. I mean, we wouldn't have had the women's right to vote if we hadn't had our male allies in Parliament. Then it took a huge amount of time. But in the end, of course, you know, we are living in a society where we have just over 50% of women and the other half men. So, you know, where would we be if we are just sort of splitting our society and say that on one hand we've got women and on the other hand we have men, obviously the transgender community. But, you know, where would we be if we're just splitting ourselves rather than looking at this as an issue that concerns us all? I said previously about workplace harassment. This is aimed at creating better workplaces for all, not just for women. So, you know, absolutely, I see every man as my ally in this. And I appeal to you to see what huge advantages will come out of it. We'll just create better ways of communicating with each other. Consent should ultimately be the way we deal with each other, whether that's you know, in the workplace or whether that's in our sexual relationships. You know, where would we be if we look at you know, men and women as in permanent battle with each other in conflict before the world if it was like this? So please come on board, you know.
No, definitely. And you know, I think one of the most interesting and important conversations is about the education to young boys in schools around what isn't acceptable behavior, what isn't acceptable practice. Can you quickly come in on that? What role do you think that plays?
Yeah, well, it's hugely important. This is a very important issue for educators, but also for families. If families don't have open discussions with their children about sexual relationships, and then all your information you get about sexual relationships from pornography, then, you know, we're in a bad place. We need to give young people good relationship education, and that should start in schools. And I've asked for a long time that shouldn't just be, you know, by some math or English or language teacher, like I had to do because I'm a former language teacher, and then you had to do these lessons. I think it should be done by specialists, by people who really know their stuff and who can really guide young people in the wrong direction about this hugely important issue of relationships.
Okay, thank you to Vera Hobhouse, a Liberal Democrat MP for Bath, who has been working on making misogyny a hate crime and explicitly covered by UK law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Ellie, we've heard, you know, I think two key things from Vera there. One is specifically this call to make misogyny a hate crime, a recorded hate crime. And what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as I've sort of been saying, I think throughout today's episode, is that like anything that shows that we are taking violence against women and girls seriously, that this is a serious issue that actually has huge impact, is welcome. You know, obviously, I know people have concerns about, I think it was described as a banter ban, and mm-hmm. you know, not being able, you know, having like their thoughts or their jokes policed. And I think it's really important that we try and get away from that kind of narrative, because that's not what this is about. It is about women who are having to work in really, really uncomfortable environments, being protected, and there being an actual way of saying, no, actually, this is harassment and this is having a huge impact on my life. And I think that creating that space, and, you know, like Vera said, this has cross-party support. It is a very popular motion within Westminster. And I think that it's really important that people understand that this isn't, you know, it's not, we're not trying to police what you're saying. We're not trying to make it a difficult working environment for men. It's just about, in cases where our women are facing harassment and sometimes abuse, making sure that they are well protected.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's coming out of the show today is we're talking about both, you know, the criminal justice element of it, the police and the conviction rates and other things, and things being made into hate crimes. And we're talking about the preventative elements, the education, the cultural work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, one of the things that I hope people take away is when it comes to the misogyny, gender-based violence, harassment, assault, we're lacking in both areas. We're both not doing a lot of the preventative work that we've done. And the criminal justice system often fails women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and that's something that in the documentary that I made, that we highlighted, there is a real drive to always turn to the police, to turn to the courts, to try and look at how we can punish people for their actions whenever we talk about gender-based violence. And actually, I think that what we need is a real understanding of why this is happening, and it needs to be more educational. Like, we need to be understanding why young boys are watching Andrew Tate and why they're subscribing to that viewpoint, and things need to be changing before we get the Wayne Cousins of the world. And I think that, you know, when we talk about these bills and we talk about making misogyny a hate crime, there's suddenly this huge reluctance where it's like, whoa, are we not going to be able to do anything? And, you know, things are going too far. And are we going to be locked up for wolf whistling? And it's like, no one's going to be locked up for wolf whistling. That's not mm-hmm. what we're saying. It's just sending a message that these are serious, serious acts of harassment, which do have a huge impact on women and girls' lives, while also trying to educate people so that those behaviours don't happen in the first place.
Yeah. And so joining us now, we have Jess Lee, a spokesperson for Our Streets Now, a women-based activist in Sussex. We're going to very pleased to have Jess with us. Jess has worked across a range of charities, mainly campaigning against sexual harassment, did a TEDx talk that was pretty viral around street harassment, titled Street Harassment, It's Not Okay. And has spoken in the House of Lords about issues facing girls in the 21st century. Jess, thank you so much for joining us. We're really delighted to have you. I'm in the studio here with Ellie Flynn, who's an investigative journalist. And first, I wondered if you can tell us a little bit about the work of Our Streets Now.
Our Streets Now was set up just over 3.5 years ago by two sisters, Myra and Gemma Tutton. They experienced a moment that basically turned into a movement. They experienced harassment and thought, you know what, we're not going to stand for this anymore. So they set up a petition to make it a criminal offence to harass women and girls in this country. That was 3 years ago. In the first 100 days, it received over 100,000 signatures. And I joined just over 2.5 years ago to work on the education side and the preventative side. That petition now stands at nearly 500,000 signatures. We have delivered sessions all across the UK in education. We've spoken on media outlets all across England and Wales, and also spoken with government, parliament, to kind of make this become on the agenda, and also make sure that every young person, every teacher, every professional gets taught about this thing that we call public sexual harassment.
And so what are some of the main calls that you may have? So if I was Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer as the next Prime Minister, you know, and you had my ear for the next 90 seconds, what would be the main cause?
That PSH is an everyday reality for many women, girls and marginalised genders, and that it's something that we experience on a daily basis. Our laws reflect our culture, and currently in UK law, it's very, very fragmented. And bringing a case to police of street harassment will normally be dismissed because there is no law, cohesive law covering public sexual harassment. Secondly, nowhere on the relationships and sex education curriculum does it ever mention being taught about street harassment. Yeah, there's a bit of sex education on there. Yeah, there's a bit of healthy relationships. There's nothing to do with street harassment. And going into schools with a couple of different charities, I hear these conversations around Andrew Tate, around misogyny, around hate, around all of these awful things on a daily basis. And the less you make it mandatory to talk to young people about this and give teachers the time to be able to teach this and express this, we're in very, very dangerous territory.
And what do you think needs to be done to try and deter young boys from following Andrew Tate, from subscribing to that kind of viewpoint? Do you think that schools or the government are doing enough to try and counter that?
Absolutely, absolutely not. We know Andrew Tate is not new. His ideas are not new. We had Jordan Peterson before him and more men before that. I've had young boys, I was in a school a couple months ago, and a young boy said to me, Andrew Tate's like a father figure to him, which I just think is really sad, that if that's the role model boys are kind of prescribing to, that's not good enough. I've got a brother, he's 16 years old, very much a businessman, a hustler. And the first conversation I had with him with Andrew Tate was really difficult. A lot of the boys say, you know, but he's a good person who does bad things. And until we start talking about masculinity with our boys, with our men, with every single person, about masculinity does not mean you can never cry. It does not mean that you never have to talk about your mental health. Again, I think we're on a very, very dangerous path. I think there's no space for boys to talk about these things. Where do they go if they're experiencing this? Who do they go to? There's no kind of space to go, you know what, you can go here. And that's why charities like Beyond Equality, like Bold Voices, have kind of had to be set up, because there's no other space for boys or men to go to talk about these things. And I think a lot of boys feel angry at the moment, especially kind of the white working class boys I work with. They're angry. They feel attacked because they're being called racist and misogynistic by the systems we live in. And they need someone to blame it on. And that blame is then put on women and girls, and they're kind of being spearheaded by people like Andrew Tate. But he's definitely not new. It's just the way that our media works. He seems to be more everywhere than perhaps Jordan Peterson or other people were previously.
Yeah.
And so what do you think can be done to include boys in the conversation more, to make them feel a part of this and not excluded from it?
Yeah, I think absolutely has to be framed that boys and men are part of the solution. They are absolutely part of creating a better world for everybody. I think secondly, it's that misogyny harms everybody. This is not just about women and girls being harmed. This is about men not being able to share their emotions. It's about the standards of different kind of men. The biggest killer of men is suicide, as you kind of get between the 21 and 45 year old age bracket. I think even starting in school from like in year six, I remember we were separated into boys and girls, and one group learned about periods and the other learned about sex, when actually, you know, I think we should both be learning about all these things, because they'll all impact us kind of once in their lives. So I think it is about, from 6 years old, from very young age, being taught about consent and respect, and, you know, kind of just that you keep your hands to yourself, we respect one another and we're kind, and then building up that as they grow. But I do think the more you talk about something, the less stigma it has, the less fear it holds, and the less power it holds. So we have to be having these conversations, and we have to continue talking about these things, not just when people like Sarah Everard are murdered, not just when another Andrew Tate comes into the world, because there will be another one. There'll be plenty more, but on a continual basis.
Yeah. And I think it's also about facilitating conversations to learn from each other's experiences. That's often been some of, for me personally, the most powerful moments of learning, is where I get to hear from women's experiences. So I think for all of the men listening, they will be astounded at the scale of public harassment, the everyday public harassment that women face. Is that something that you think, you know, needs to get out there for, I mean, I should also say on the record, you know, men also do occasionally experience it. It's at a far less frequency, but the consistency when I have spoken to friends, family, colleagues, and you know, women like yourselves, the frequency at which it happens to women in the public is astounding, and I don't think people know, men particularly.
No, I remember when I did my TED talk when I was 18 and I'm 22 now, so it's nearly 4 years ago. I had so many men, specifically dads, come up to me afterwards and go, I'm so sorry, I didn't know. I had no idea. And over the years, I can even now get messages saying, you know, I had a conversation with my daughter or my niece and she'd never told me about that. She now takes the different route home to school because there's a flasher in the woods, or she's experienced this on the bus home. I think if any men are listening, I urge you to have a conversation with the women and girls in your life, because I can almost assure you that every single one of them will have a story, and that story will be really sad and really upsetting. And I think that's why I started doing this work, is because eventually when I'm a mum or my cousin's older, I truly hope no one ever has to go through some of the stuff that I did whilst growing up, the relentless harassment, the shouting, the grabbing, the groping. And yeah, I think men and boys don't always realise it's a problem until they see it or they experience it themselves.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jess. That was Jess Lee, a spokesperson for Our Streets Now, a women's based activist in Sussex who has worked across a range of charities, mainly campaigning on sexual harassment. Jess, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, we've got the word on the street. This is where our wonderful producers go out onto the streets to find out what people really think. And we'll hear about that after this.
FUBAR Radio presents Access All Areas.
We have our final guest, Chloe Vetch, on.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, you're right. So, what is your type? So, obviously, so many mates are writing in the DMs.
I go for medium ugly.
Mm. Oh.
But hear me out. I didn't realise this until after my last ex. When I looked back at my exes and I was like, wow, because love is really blind. I'm like, okay, this is clearly my type.
Access All Areas. Every Thursday.
FUBAR Radio.
Right, so coming up next, we have one of my favourite segments of the show, which is Word on the Street, where we get to hear from real people. Not that the people we haven't heard today aren't real people, but people on the street. And today we asked them, if you were to ban one antisocial behaviour, what would it be and why?
I would ban spitting on the street, mainly because I think it's really unnecessary. And I think if you're doing it out of anger, there are better ways to express or deal with your anger than spitting on the street.
These idiots that park these rented Lime bikes right across the pavements, in across driveways, across people's doorways, they should be fined for that, and the money should be sent to charity.
Catcalling, I don't think it's fair at all how, like, especially men can make people just feel so uncomfortable and unsafe when they're just walking around. And it's just a horrible feeling.
Congregations of large groups of sort of young people. My son recently got admitted to hospital through violence, through that, just not letting someone join them for football. Ended up in hospital with 4 stitches inside his mouth and 3 on the outside. Just through violence, through a big group congregating.
Abusive behaviour. I just think there's no excuse for being abusive, especially towards people that can't defend themselves.
People texting on their phones while they're crossing roads, and also when they're on bikes.
Well, I actually think that banning antisocial behaviour isn't the way to go. I think we need to encourage pro-social behaviour. So I wouldn't ban antisocial behaviour. I would find ways to make people behave in a pro-social manner and socialise better, because there is enough staff banned out there that is not effective, and people do those things anyway. So it's, for me, more interesting question is how we can invest into infrastructures and activities that actually will result in less antisocial behaviour.
Perfume on the tube.
Why?
It makes me gag.
Perfume on the tube. That caught me. I didn't see that one coming. So, Ellie, if you were to ban one antisocial behaviour, what would it be and why?
following someone. I think there's just nothing quite like the threat of someone walking closely behind you late at night, particularly. So yeah, without a doubt, that'd be it for me.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, and we come to the end of what has been a amazing show, and I know I have learned so much. First of all, a huge thank you to Ellie Flynn, who has been a fantastic co-host. Thank you so much for joining us. And to all of our guests today, Shea Falloodin-Labud, co-founder of Level Up, Vera Hobhouse, Liberal Democrat MP for Bath, and Jess Lee, spokesperson for Our Streets Now. Make sure to follow us on Instagram on Politics Uncensored. You can also find us on demand on podcast form on all good podcasts and platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. And you can follow me on Twitter at @ARMilani_. You can search Ali Milani. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Next week, we have a great show where we're going to be talking about the future of healthcare in the UK and the future of the NHS and how future-proof our National Health Service is, and we'll be joined by actress Nicola Thorpe. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Salams.